from WBUR in Boston. I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Say It Ain't So, Sammy Sosa. Just ahead on Only a Game, Tim Kirkchen on the news that the former Cubs slugger was one of the 104 major leaguers who tested positive in 2003 for performance-enhancing drugs. Also, we'll put a Father's Day spin on the 2009 Major League Baseball draft, and John Feinstein recalls last year's U.S. Open playoff between Rocco Mediate and Tiger Woods. Also ahead, Only a Game's microphones capture the irreverence, the utter lack of politesse, and the ungolfish fun at the 16th hole of TPC Scottsdale.
The year I won, I hit it on the green about 30 feet behind the hole, and I putted about 8 feet by, and one guy said, "Too bad Tiger's taking you out, you're choking."
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. In olden days, they called the folks who followed baseball bugs. For years, the bugs have buzzed about how baseball's rife with drugs. For some, it seems a tragedy. For others, not so much. The story calls, it seems to me, for Kirkchen's Golden Touch. And so I'm joined by ESPN's Tim Kirkchen. Tim, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill.
On Tuesday, the New York Times broke the story that Sammy Sosa was among the once mostly anonymous players who tested positive for performance-enhancing drugs back in 2003. You have expressed the opinion that baseball's steroids era could go on for 20 years, but wouldn't it be best for Major League Baseball and the Players Union to recognize the inevitable and finally reveal all the names on that list of 104 players and just move on?
Well, I think in a way that would be the best thing to do, to just get it over with. But my concern here, Bill, is first off, those names were supposed to be anonymous. And even though eventually they're all going to get out, we're still going to hear other stories about guys who are not on that list, guys who used in the late 90s. And it's going to become a big story again. So there are two ways to look at this. Do we just go for the first round knockout and release them all and get it over in one fell swoop and have two miserable weeks? Or do we have a 15-round TKO and every 3 or 4 months have to deal with another story? I'm not sure what's the best thing to do. All I know is I don't like either option. But unfortunately, this remains a big story because some of the guys we're talking about are going to be up for the Hall of Fame. And every single time the voting comes up, we're going to have to revisit the steroid story.
Speaking of moving on or not moving on, Manny Ramirez will apparently report to the minors next week in preparation for his return to the major leagues on July 3rd. But do the Dodgers really need Manny Ramirez at this point?
Well, they don't. They've played even better without him. Juan Pierre, who's a quality Major League Baseball player, has filled in for Manny and has done things extremely well on and off the field, as he always has. But at the same time, Manny is a really good hitter still, and people love to watch him play, even with what he did this year. And I think there'll be a better team with him when he comes back. It's a tricky situation because they're 21 games over 500, and they played just as well without Manny. But he's under contract. They're paying him a lot of money. People love to watch him play, so I say bring him back.
A quick glance at the National League Central standings reveals that the Brewers are out in front of the Cardinals. Will that slim margin hold for very long?
I don't think so. I think the Cardinals are going to end up beating the Brewers, and I'm still, of course, keeping my eye on the Cubs to see if they can beat the Cardinals. Of course, I picked the Cubs to win the World Series this year, so I'm keeping a very close eye on them, even though they're way back in the pack right now. The Brewers are a really interesting team, Bill, in that they lost their two best pitchers at points last year, were in the offseason, Ben Sheets and CC Sabathia. No one gave them a chance, and yet here they are again with pretty good pitching, but more important, a really, really good offensive club that can just pound you. They just clobbered the Indians 3 games in a row. So they're a very interesting team and a young team with a lot of spirit.
Tim, let's forego discussion of the Phillies-Mets battle for National League East supremacy and focus instead on the ongoing freak show that is the Washington Nationals. Salary-skimming scandals, exploding sausages showering the fans with meat, misspelled team names, a chance to be the worst franchise in history in terms of their record on the field. Can it get any weirder than this?
Well, here's how it can get weirder, okay? They signed or they drafted Steven Strasburg as the number one player in the country in the first-year player draft this year. Now, two things could happen. They draft him and are not able to sign him by August 15th, and he goes back in the draft next year. Or they sign him to some record-setting number that completely changes the face of the draft, which in either case, they're going to get pounded for it. If they don't sign him, they're going to say, oh, same old Nationals, too cheap to sign their number one. And if they sign him for a record setting, they're going to say, oh, look what the Nationals did. They ruined the way the draft is run. But you have to give them credit for one thing. They shut out the Yankees the other night. They beat the Yankees in a three-game series. Get this. They had the worst record 50 games into the season of any team in history ever to win a series from the Yankees, and they had the second worst record ever by a team to shut out the Yankees. The only team that had a worse record was the 1916 A's, who were 22-81 when they shut out the Yankees.
The Detroit Tigers appear to have righted what was wrong with them last season, but then on Thursday, the team placed starting pitcher Dontrell Willis on the DL for an anxiety disorder. Can the Tigers continue their success without Dontrell Willis on the active roster?
Yes, he didn't do much to help them, Bill. And this is a really sad case, an anxiety disorder. What it really is a guy who can't locate home plate anymore. And nobody should laugh at that because this guy's been throwing strikes his entire life. But the last few years, something has happened, and now he can't do it anymore. Much like Rex Barney and Steve Blass and Joe Cowley and Chuck Knobloch. They can't throw it where they want to anymore. And that's what's happened to poor Dontrell Willis. But the good thing for the Tigers is, frankly, they don't need him right now. They have enough starting pitching. Their offense has gotten started again. So they're a pretty good club with or without him, but they need to get that poor guy straightened out in the minor league somehow. They've already tried it once, and it didn't work. Some guys never pull out of it. Tino Martinez, the first baseman for the Yankees, once told me that Chuck Knobloch would catch a routine ground ball and throw it 20 feet over his head. It's impossible to do that unless you have this disease or whatever we call it, and very, very few guys have gotten through this.
Tim, which teams have we missed that seem worthy of mention at this stage of the season? And I don't just mean because they're ahead of the Cubs.
I think a team to keep an eye on who we don't talk about much is the Cincinnati Reds. They've had all sorts of issues, injuries and everything else, and they're hanging right in there. And I think they're going to be in the NL Central race for the rest of the year if they can get their pitching healthy again. And I saw them the other day, and Dusty Baker, their manager, was telling me, you know, we have to win every game by one run. 3-2, 4-3. We never beat anybody 8-1. But some of their guys said maybe that's a good thing. Maybe it really toughens you up. But Dusty said, I'd love to win one 10-1 sometime. That just doesn't happen very often with the Reds.
Tim Kirkjian disseminates diamond dealings for ESPN, and he joins me from time to time here on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Bill.
In honor of Father's Day weekend, it's perhaps worth mentioning that in this spring's Major League Baseball draft, almost 30 draftees were the sons of fellows who'd played in the big leagues, a circumstance that led a West Coast fan to fantasize this week about future drafts.
I don't know. Does Manny Ramirez have any kids?
That fan, who identified himself only as Jeff, was in Boston for what turned out to be a rain-shortened game on Thursday night. When I ran into him at the souvenir shop across the street from a soggy Fenway Park, I couldn't resist asking him if he'd like to see a third-generation Bonds playing for the Giants.
Not going there. I'm not going that route because I'll just spend the next 10 minutes just chastising him and chastising the Giants for covering him up and... Yeah, that's a different story. But no, that's probably one person I would not want to see is anybody who's related to Barry Bonds.
Okay, but most of the drafted sons of former major leaguers offer stories that are more upbeat, hence more appropriate for Father's Day. Consider, for example, Shane McCaddy, whose father, Steve, pitched for 9 years in Oakland. Steve is currently the pitching coach for the Washington Nationals. Son Shane caught the eye of some of Steve's colleagues when he was playing catch in the outfield during a recent Nationals homestand. And the team drafted him, which, no surprise, delighted Dad.
Oh, yeah, I was extremely, extremely happy for him. You know, it's like I was never drafted. So, you know, all of us dads, just being a dad, let alone being a former major league player and a pitching coach, you know, you always want your kid to do well.
McCaddy the elder acknowledges that he wouldn't mind at all if McCaddy the younger made it to the big club while dad was still the pitching coach.
Well, I mean, sure, that would be neat, but I'm just dad. And like any dad working with his kid, you know, there's many afternoons where I would take him out and work with him in the cages. You know, within 5 minutes, I got my back turned, throwing a ball off the wall. He's hitting his glove off the wall because he's mad. Quit saying this. Leave me alone. Hey, old man, I know what I'm doing. It's like you didn't even play the game to them.
Shane McCaddy, drafted in the 34th round, has to be considered something of a long shot to ascend to the majors. Not so with K.C. Hobson, who was drafted in the 6th round by the Toronto Blue Jays. His father, Butch Hobson, late a third baseman with the Red Sox and the Yankees, is managing the Southern Maryland Blue Crabs in the Atlantic League. He acknowledges that he helped K.C. out when he could, but tried not to overmanage his career.
Dad spent most of the time in the batting cage with him, and, you know, when he turned 15, he started listening a little bit more. Dad and Mom have stepped back and said, son, this is your decision, it's your life, and we're going to support you whatever you decide to do.
I wish I could do it more often as a father myself.
Now, when it comes to other things, we always put our 2 cents worth in. But when it comes to this, he's worked very hard for this, and he's always wanted to play professional baseball.
Having seen Butch Hobson play in Boston 30-odd years ago, I couldn't help but wonder out loud whether he was entirely happy with which team had drafted his son.
Would I have liked to have seen him in a Boston Red Sox uniform one day? Dead gum right I would. But, you know, I get emails every day managing in the Atlantic League from players that didn't get drafted.
The search for these stories turned up evidence that the drafting of the offspring of a major leaguer can be taken to an extreme. Consider, for example, one of the memories of Matt Merulo, who caught for the Chicago White Sox and whose grandfather, Lenny, played shortstop for the Cubs.
I remember hanging out there in batting practice out in Chicago while I was playing with the White Sox and found out that Ron Shuler's daughter had been drafted in about the 48th round in probably 1992. And granted, she could track a fly ball down better than some of the guys we had in the outfield on any given day.
What was Mr. Shuler's position at that point?
He was general manager, but he did fall into the category of former major league player.
Matt's father, who might well have made the big leagues himself were it not for an injury, has the distinction of being the son and the dad of a major league player. And Matt still recalls how his father responded on the catcher's draft day 23 years ago.
My father just was beaming. I remember him just sitting in the chair and had his hands folded over his chest, and his thumbs were twiddling about, you know, 100 miles an hour, and big ear-to-ear grin on his face. Probably just more emotions being, you know, passed back and forth just through, you know, the look and expression on his face than any words.
Since radio is a poor medium for conveying facial expressions, I'll go with words. Happy Father's Day, just a day early, to all the dads who are listening and to their dads, too.
My dad, now here is a man. To me, he is everything strong. No, he can't do wrong.
It's 19 minutes past the hour.
He comes.
Boogie-dee, boogie-dee.
There goes.
Boogie-dee, boogie-dee.
The naked rugby match in Dunedin, New Zealand, caught nobody by surprise. After all, the tradition has been part of the celebration of New Zealand's National Nude Day for some years now. But that's not to say this year's edition of the Nude Rugby International didn't offer a wrinkle so unusual that even the players were caught off guard to the extent that they temporarily halted the game. The spectacle that interrupted their match? The brief appearance of a streaker who ran across their rugby pitch fully clothed.
This is your action news reporter once again, and we're here at the gas station. Pardon me, sir, did you see what happened?
Yeah, Dave. I was just in here getting my tires checked, and he just appeared out of the traffic. Just come streaking around the grease right there. Didn't have nothing on but a smile.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the city that hosts the Olympic Games risks losing money, and London, the host of the 2012 Games, may be risking a great deal more. But first, the 2009 U.S. Open Golf Tournament seems destined to become known as one of the wettest and most discombobulated editions of that classic. I'd say that rain interrupted play on Thursday, except that it was more like play briefly interrupted the rain. Round one spilled over into Friday, and many of the competitors didn't finish that first round until late yesterday afternoon. Forecasts of more wet weather have organizers scrambling and competitors starting and stopping and starting again. Through the first round, Mike Weir was the leader at 6-under par. Sweden's Peter Hansen completed the first round at 4-under, and David Duval was among several players at 3-under. Rocco Mediate, about whom more very soon, stood at 2-under par through 18, and defending champion Tiger Woods was 4-over par, 10 shots off the pace after the first round. Second round play will get underway this morning unless it is raining again at Bethpage Black, which, given the weather over the past 2 days, would seem to be an excellent bet. Whatever happens this weekend at the U.S. Open is unlikely to top last year's event for drama. In a playoff that looked as if it might go on forever, Tiger Woods, playing on a torn knee and a broken leg, outlasted Rocco Mediate, who appeared to be having a wonderful time. In his new book, Are You Kidding Me?, John Feinstein tells the story of that memorable match and the long and stumbling road that led Rocco Mediate to his playoff against Woods. John Feinstein joins me now from the studios of WLIU in Southampton, New York. John, welcome back to Only a Game.
Bill, good to talk to you. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. The popular perception of the playoff between Rocco Mediate and Tiger Woods was that the greatest golfer of all time would brush off this career journeyman, best known for his gift of gab and his cranky back. But Mediate had won millions of dollars on the PGA Tour. He was no slouch, right?
No. The notion that Rocco was tin cup is a lot overrated. In fact, before he hurt his back in 1993, he'd been consistently ranked in the top 20 in the world. He'd won five times. He won five times on the PGA Tour. He even beat Tiger after he came back from his back surgery head-to-head in a tournament in Phoenix. So he had experience with it. And a lot of people wonder just how good a player Rocco would have been if he had not had back miseries literally for 14 years. So you're right. He was a very solid player. However, going into that Open, because he had struggled in 2008, he was ranked 158th in the world and had to go through a playoff in the qualifier just to participate in the Open. So to say he was an underdog is certainly not an exaggeration.
For listeners who may not be entirely familiar with how the U.S. Open differs from virtually every other golf tournament, when things are tied at the end of regulation, they go to an 18-hole playoff. So tell us a little bit about how this all unspooled.
Well, the Open is, in fact, the only one of the major championships that has an 18-hole playoff on Monday. Everyone else decides it through some form of either sudden death or a 3- or 4-hole playoff on Sunday evening when there's a tie. The Open is anachronistic. They insist on the 18-hole playoff, which is usually anticlimactic. The players are tired, the fans are tired, and the play usually isn't very good. This playoff was the exception, maybe because Rocco and Tiger are so comfortable with one another. They've known each other for years. They both played great golf throughout, and it produced one of the most dramatic finishes ever. The only bad news about it, Bill, is that it now gives the USGA an excuse to keep having the 18-hole playoff for another 20 years.
And, of course, this time around, it was a 19-hole playoff because even after 18, they needed one more.
Well, I asked David Fay, the executive director of the USGA, who says, well, sudden death is unfair because you can decide the winner on a fluke shot. I said, what's the difference between sudden death after 90 holes and 72 holes? I'm still waiting for the answer.
Do you think Rocco Mediate was surprised when the playoff ended as it did with Tiger Woods once again holding the championship trophy?
I don't think he was surprised. I know he was disappointed. I know he believed he had a chance to win until that last putt on the sudden death playoff hole went wide left and he knew he had lost. And interestingly, Bill, I don't think it really hit him that he lost until months later. He was riding this wave of euphoria because, as he said, people acted as if he'd won. They would come up to him and say, that was incredible. I've never seen anything like that, the way you stood in and the way you made those 3 straight birdies on the back nine on Monday. And he said sometimes he had to look at people and say, thanks, I'm very proud of the way I played. But Tiger did win. And I think it was only maybe 6 months down the line that he looked up and said, gosh, you know, that might have been my only chance to win a major championship. And then it really did hit him.
When you talk about the attention that followed the tournament, it's easy to imagine that another golfer might have been thoroughly distracted and his game totally thrown off. But Rocco Mediate really seems to be a guy who enjoyed making the rounds of, you know, Letterman and the late night shows and all the rest of it very much.
Yeah, you know, it's a very interesting point because, like you, I've spent a fair amount of time with public figures in my life. And frequently when you're in a restaurant or you're out in public with them and people come up and they want an autograph or to take a picture or, you know, just to talk, to tell them where they were when something happened, guys will tolerate it. And, you know, in the personal walk away, and they'll roll their eyes and say, okay, that was the 47th time today. Rocco treated every single person who came up to him as if they were the first ones ever. And I think he really reveled in it. He liked meeting new people. He liked the attention. He liked the conversation. He just has that kind of Lee Trevino personality that everybody he meets is a new friend.
Well, you mentioned his personality, and certainly there is much that's attractive about Rocco Mediate. On the other hand, at the same time that he was on the brink of entering the brightest spotlight that he had ever experienced, his marriage was ending. You and he acknowledged that on the rare occasions when he was home with his wife and children, he was getting drunk and playing video poker 8 hours a day. I wonder, was he reluctant to have you include that business in the book?
I would say yes and no. The yes part is he was reluctant for all the reasons you would be reluctant about something like that. The no part is that part of his life was a few years behind, the part where he'd been drinking really to mask the pain from his back injury that kept coming back, playing too much video poker, his marriage crumbling for all the reasons that marriages crumble in situations like that. So he had a little bit of separation from it and was better able to talk about it as a result.
Rocco Mediate had had a bad back, of course, for years. When he turned the problem over to a physical therapist named Cindy Hilfman, whom you've mentioned, with whom he eventually became involved. I'm sure that you've heard about how women in labor always fall in love with the anesthesiologist, John. Was there some of that going on in the Mediate-Hilfman relationship?
Probably. Rocco is someone who no one is ever a good guy. You're either the greatest or the worst. This wine is the best or the worst. You must order this meal because it's the greatest thing ever cooked, or don't touch that because it will kill you. And when Rocco met Cindy, and Cindy was able to find a way to help him with his back, and Cindy is a sweet, nice person in addition to all that, I think he fell in love like that. And he was searching for something. His marriage had already been in difficulty prior to meeting Cindy. And so I think, you know, it was one of those things where the sun and the moon aligned and it all happened very quickly and it became very intense, and it is very intense. And Cindy is now battling her own terrible health problem with this kidney disease that she's had for years that's put her in and out of the hospital constantly for the last year. So in many ways, the last 12 months of Rocco's life have been, to quote Rocco, the greatest and the worst all at once.
It may seem a trivial question at this point, but how is his golf game these days?
You know, it's been a struggle, partly because of what's been going on with Cindy. He spent a lot of time sitting in hospital rooms with her, staying up at night in the middle of tournaments when she's had to go to the hospital. He hasn't finished higher than 18th in a tournament this year. The one thing I will say is going back to Bethpage, I think, gave him a breath of new energy because all the fans were there reminding him about what happened at Torrey Pines last year. It's his kind of golf course, and I know he's hoping that as the summer goes along and they're playing the major championships that he can find that magic again.
John, as a guy who has followed the PGA for a good long while, are you already trying to imagine how this year's Open can produce a storyline that's as much fun as last year's was?
Well, I doubt if you're going to have anything with a personality like Rocco. He is unique, the most overused word in sports, unique, but he is, in fact, one of a kind.
At least you didn't say really unique.
Or very unique, as every radio host I know except for you says all the time. But people have asked me going into the Open, well, what kind of story would it be if Phil Mickelson were to win weeks after learning that his wife, Amy, has to have surgery for breast cancer? And I said, well, there wouldn't be a book then. I'd get skipped and they'd go straight to Hollywood with that story. there are always storylines out there in golf. And the thing that's great about it, Bill, is we never know when they're going to happen. No one, with the possible exception of Rocco, thought for 1 second that he was going to contend in last year's Open, that he was going to be the guy going head-to-head with Tiger. And yet there he was with the stock market literally coming to a semi-halt. This is before it crashed on Monday in the playoff, going head-to-head with arguably the greatest player of all time. As I said in the introduction, it was the matchup no one could have imagined. The greatest player of all time versus the greatest player in the history of Greensburg, Pennsylvania.
John Feinstein is the author of Are You Kidding Me? And he joined me from WLIU in Southampton, New York. John, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Bill, thanks as always.
'Cause I want to be like Nicklaus, yes I do. Or maybe Arnold Palmer, he's good too. I watch him on the TV set, practice every chance I get. I want to be like Nicklaus, yes I do.
You can take a closer listen to this week's stories, find a link to our weekly podcasts, or peruse our archives by visiting our website at onlyagame.org.
If I could only hit them straight, I'd have a better score. Instead, I'd take a 5, mark down 3, and holler 4. Oh, but I want to be like Nicklaus, yes, I do. Or maybe Arnold Palmer, he's good too. I watch him on the TV set, practice every chance I get. I want to be like Nicklaus, yes I do. Lord, I want to be like Nicklaus, yes I do.
Late last week, workers constructing a road that will carry visitors to the 2012 Olympic Games in London uncovered what appears to be a mass grave. There is speculation that the bones found therein may be those of Britons dismembered and beheaded when soldiers of faraway Rome overran the land about 43 AD. Though foul play is a near certainty, officials in Great Britain have said there is no reason to delay Olympics-related construction or improvements. And now, through the magic of radio, let us, you and I, leap forward in time to the 2012 Olympics in London, where a fun and festive time is no doubt being had by all. What the?
Nothing to see here. Move along.
What seems to be the problem?
Bit of confusion at the soccer stadium, Governor. Skies turned black, arms reaching up through the soil in the penalty box, grabbing some of the players, that sort of thing. Made a mess of the pitch it has. May not be enough boys left to finish the game.
Oh, the humanity!
Let's keep our wits about us, shall we? Nothing to be gained by panicking, I shouldn't think.
Good Lord, now what?
It's the Greek high jumper. Or it was. He ran down the thing there, launched himself into space, and now he's gone.
Rubbish.
Gone?
He never came down. It's as if he was swallowed up by the earth. This place is cursed.
Nothing to see here. Move along.
Nothing to see is right. He's just gone.
Not entirely as it happens. Look here.
Oh, my God! It's his head!
Put the bones back where you bloody found them, you kids.
It speaks!
Behave yourself, madam, or I'll have to ask you to leave the game.
You don't have to ask. I can't stay in this land of death. I'm out of here.
Where'd she go?
I'm sure she's fine. Probably off to see the aquatic events, I guess.
The water! The water in the pool! It's not water! It's red! It's bubbling up from...
Can we get back to 2009? Cue the traveling music, please.
I now declare the 20th Olympic Summer Games closed.
Thank goodness. Do you suppose it's too late to consider relocating the 2012 Games to a site where nobody's discovered an ancient mass grave? You're listening to Only a Game. In my conversation on last week's program with Charlie Pierce, the subject of a new world record came up. Said record involved non-stop singing, and the woman who broke that record, Karen Davey, is a Dolly Parton impersonator. Charlie's offhand remark about how Ms. Davy must have sung Coat of Many Colors over and over again drew the ire of many listeners. John Dennis, who listens to the program on North Country Public Radio in Canton, New York, referred to Charlie as ignorant and urged him to do his homework. Althea Webb, who hears Only a Game on KERA in North Texas, went to greater lengths. You mentioned the redoubtable Dolly Parton and cast aspersions on her oeuvre when you expressed doubt that a marathon of her music would be sustainable. You should know, sirs, that Miss Parton's career has spanned 40 years, and her individual published works registered with BMI number almost 600 songs. Ms. Webb goes on to work out the math regarding how long somebody could go on singing Dolly Parton songs without a repeat selection, and closes her email with, "Fie, gentlemen! Let that be a lesson to think before you speak." Millie Fortune Gilpin also emailed us this week in response to my conversation with Kelly Anderson about basketball star Shamiqua Holdsclaw's battle with depression and our story about Major League pitcher Zach Greinke, who has struggled with social anxiety disorder. Ms. Fortune Gilpin wrote, "Thanks for humanizing mental health conditions. I enjoy your show because of the interesting sports stories, but it also demonstrates that individuals who deal with anxiety can have satisfying careers in sports." And finally, Nancy Jackson, who hears the program on WUOM in Michigan, emailed to take issue with hockey analyst Helene Elliott's grim take on Detroit. Her comments painted an unfairly gloomy picture, Ms. Jackson wrote. "Detroit is making a super comeback, and things are better here than they have been in a long time." You can write us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860, or you can reach us through our website, onlyagame.org.
The last letter that you wrote was on a blue piece of paper. That old feeling's back, the clouds are moving in. The beginning of the end is near. I feel your love is fading in the darkness. Seems I have no prayer.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at avfx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In a variation of the actress discovered while she's sipping something sweet at a soda fountain, sprinter Jeffrey Lawal Balogun got his big break while running to catch a bus. 4 years ago, as he raced for the ride that would get him to his college class on time, Balogun was noticed by a track coach who encouraged him to train in the dash. Now, Balogun is Great Britain's sixth fastest runner, and he's hoping to compete in the 2012 Olympics. "I never thought running after a bus would lead to all this," said Balogun recently, "and the funny thing is, I missed it." I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, a place where the stodgy rules of golf simply don't apply. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
I was going to ask you if you thought Tiger Woods would win the U.S. Open, but maybe the more appropriate question is, do you think they can finish the tournament before next week's PGA tilt in Connecticut?
Yes, it rained a lot, and things got all wet in the early rounds.
Greens included.
And mostly, yeah, I love the scene of the guys with the little rollers getting the water off the green. That's terrific. Yeah, I mean, this is what happens when you play a golf tournament out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean in a very kind of foul weather springtime. Tiger's first round, which of course took 2 days to play, wound up with him four over. He's got a long haul to come back. But in a tournament like this with the stops and starts and who knows when it's supposed to rain all weekend, I mean, I hesitate to say anything could happen. But you know what, Bill? Anything can happen.
On Monday, the Stanley Cup champion Pittsburgh Penguins were celebrated with a parade, which conveniently followed the same route the Steelers parade had followed a few months back. Time to salute Pittsburgh as title town?
Well, for the moment, and who knows what will happen if the Red Sox manage to win another World Series, Boston will start bragging about it again, and on we go.
Elsewhere in the National Hockey League, regarding the migration of the Coyotes from Phoenix to Hamilton, Ontario, a bankruptcy judge said not so fast. What's the problem?
Well, they put a June 29th deadline on the Canadian billionaire Jim Balzerly, who wants to move it to Hamilton. The judges said, look, he didn't knock the notion of the sale down. He just said the deadline was too soon to get all the issues resolved.
The Lakers had a parade, too, even though the state of California and the city of Los Angeles don't seem to be in any position to fund a backyard barbecue, let alone a citywide celebration. How'd they get around that problem?
They found rich people, which there are several in Los
Angeles.
Still
some left in L.A.
Rumors I have. The Universal Pictures honcho Lou Wasserman's grandchildren chipped in. The guys, the former chairman of Univision, former owners of the National Sports Daily, where I worked once, and Haim and Cheryl Sabin. Haim Sabin, of course, is a big political contributor, but also is the man responsible for the phenom we like to call the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers.
There is a connection between the parade and all those things,
I'm sure. These people
finance
the parade. This is where your money's coming from. Guys in pink suits playing Godzilla.
Excellent. Just as I had anticipated. In the NBA, coaches of losing teams get fired, Charlie, even if they are very tall and they were Hall of Fame caliber players. But should Kevin McHale, late the head coach of the Timberwolves, have escaped that fate this spring?
No, probably not. I mean, his tenure as both an executive and a coach with the Timberwolves was really sort of spotty. It was under his barely perceptible leadership that they cheated with the salary cap with Joe Smith, which cost them 3 years of rebuilding and probably was the basis for what eventually became the Kevin Garnett trade. Interestingly enough, the news got out not in a press release, but because Kevin Love of the Timberwolves, their rookie center, twittered, "Today is a sad day. Kevin McHale will not be back as head coach this year." It's a new media age, Bill. What can I tell you?
You better tell me something because I don't understand it. That's for sure. In women's hoops, Epiphany Prince has decided to forego her fourth year of eligibility at Rutgers in order to play professional basketball in Europe. Ms. Prince says she just wants to move her family to a safer neighborhood and a better house. But some coaches of women's college teams are hoping out loud that this will not be the beginning of a trend. Which side are you on in this one?
I'm always on the side of the athlete deciding to do what's best for their family. And if this is what Ms. Prince can do, this is what she'll do. I do have to admit, though, I love the fact that a woman named Epiphany Prince had a coach and mentor as she was coming up whose name was Apache Pascal. This is the land of really cool names.
Earlier this week, Cleveland Browns receiver Dante Stallworth was sentenced to 30 days in jail after pleading guilty to DUI manslaughter. In response, he was suspended indefinitely without pay by the National Football League. To what extent should the punishment levied by the league outlast the punishment levied by the courts?
Well, it looks like it's going to substantially outlast every part of the punishment except for the fact that Dante Stallworth cannot have a driver's license now for the rest of his life. This is an intriguing case because Stallworth and the family of his victim came to a swift conclusion, possibly on the grounds that had he not been drinking, it might not have been his fault at all under the law. You know, Roger Goodell has been very hard-nosed about this sort of thing, and I would suspect we will not be seeing Dante Stallworth this year.
Charlie, I know that those of us who scribble about sports are supposed to be blasé about new revelations regarding Major League Baseball players and performance-enhancing drugs, but I can't help it. I was simply astonished to learn this week that Sammy Sosa tested positive back in 2003. Who would have thought it?
Well, a bunch of people who thought it was the Oversight and Government Reform Committee of the House of Representatives, in front of which Mr. Sosa denied that he had used illegal performance-enhancing drugs. He's got himself in a big pile of trouble right now. I mean, it's one thing to have your records devalued. It's another thing to be, you know, chatting with the folks and trying to get a softball game up at, you know, Danbury.
On Thursday night, Ivan Pudge Rodriguez passed Carlton Pudge Fisk for the record in games caught, which leaves me to wonder whether in the future that record should be reserved for guys named Pudge.
I was about to point out that Bob Boone, with 2,225 games, is the leader in the baseball record book for non-named Pudge catchers.
And I know that somebody's keeping track of that.
I guarantee you the Elias Sports Bureau has that up on the wall that Bob Boone has caught more games in the major leagues by anyone not named Pudge.
Charlie, as of yesterday, the world has two Formula One series as eight teams have broken away over a dispute about financial constraints.
Yeah, yeah.
F1 will lose Ferrari and its current leader, Braun GP. This strategy failed miserably for the sport of Indy racing a few years back, so
try it again, right?
Boy, this is one of those moments where you just know the guys at NASCAR are sitting back with their feet up on the desk and chuckling hysterically. It's not going to work. They'll have to come back together again. There'll be a couple of years worth of ill feelings, and you will have two circuits that nobody cares about instead of one that people marginally care about, and they'll realize the error of their ways, and the whole thing will have been a waste of time.
Tennis used to be a quiet sport. This week, aha, you anticipate my question. This week, on the eve of Wimbledon, noted conservative Martina Navratilova declared that a little less noise would be appropriate, or perhaps I should say a lot less noise would be appropriate. What is Ms. Navratilova's complaint?
Well, she says that you have to hear the ball hit the racket to know if you're hitting it properly, and that she had had problems with Monica Seles, who is probably the founder of the screaming pornographic soundtrack school of hitting a tennis ball.
Mm-hmm.
There's a woman now, Michelle Larcher de Brito. She was 16 years old, and she was so bad on the French Open that her opponent complained to the umpire saying that her noise-making was, quote, unpleasant. It's hard to argue with her. There seems to be something called a, quote-unquote, noise hindrance that's going to be put in the code of conduct. It doesn't particularly bother me one way or the other, but I do sort of wish they could keep it down just a tad, because it's beginning to sound like, you know, something you would see at a motel with revolving mirrors.
I wouldn't know anything about that.
Of course you wouldn't.
And finally, Charlie, a couple of weeks ago, the record for the largest transfer fee ever paid for a soccer player was shattered when Real Madrid put up roughly €1 billion to acquire Cristiano Ronaldo. Tell us about the impact of that deal on men's fashions.
See, Ronaldo wears these shorts that would, if I tried to put them on, I would sound like Michelle Larcher de Brito, pretty much. The sale of these skimpy shorts went up 117%. After he was photographed wearing them while he was here in the United States. And, of course, they're all being sold now in Real Madrid and so forth. And, I mean, in the immortal words of James Bond, ooh, hot pants. Get down, take it to the bridge. Ah!
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He is resplendent in long trousers today, as always. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. And his book has appeared on the New York Times bestseller list.
The extended New York Times bestseller list.
Good,
it's extended
for me.
Far enough to cover me.
Excellent. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
If you'd like to test your Only a Game aptitude, please go to our website, onlyagame.org, and follow the link to Name That Sport. After your training, you will boast complete knowledge of several sports which, though arcane, are nonetheless ridiculous. The dead silence preceding golf club hitting golf ball and the resultant polite applause is standard operating procedure all along the PGA Tour, though Bethpage Black Galleries at the 2002 and 2009 U.S. Opens have occasionally shown a willingness to stretch the definition of polite. Only a Game's Ron Schachter visited a U.S. course where polite just goes straight into the bunker each midwinter.
At first sight, there's nothing remarkable about the TPC Scottsdale 16th hole, a 162-yard par 3 with a narrow kidney-shaped green and sand traps to its left and right. Although this is the only hole along the PGA Tour completely surrounded by grandstands, it almost reached the putting surface. A dozen course marshals, quadruple the regular complement, cluster around the green poised to wave large lettered quiet signs. And the crowd send-off for each tee shot sounds more like a kickoff at a football game. When that shot lands in one of those bunkers, there's no doubt that this hole is unlike any on the rest of the PGA Tour.
It's only 162 yards!
The 16th is nicknamed the Coliseum. And more than 20,000 fans, many of them younger than at other tour stops, gather here for 4 days in midwinter to throw typical golf etiquette into the rough. Those nearest the green are quick to give thumbs up or thumbs down to the golfers approaching, including hometown favorite Phil Mickelson, who's just found the sand, and his playing partners Justin Leonard and Zach Johnson, who've reached the green.
Not so much you, Phil. Not so much you. Leonard and Johnson, well done.
And the boy Zach.
This crowd also doesn't pull any punches about missed putts.
Go to the hole.
Oh!
lovely parting gifts.
When Rocco Mediate, the runner-up in last year's U.S. Open, misses his putt for par, someone nearby shouts, "Rocco, you're a beautiful man." Mediate has played this tournament 22 times and says that he always hears something.
The year I won, I hit it on the green about 30 feet behind the hole, and I putted about 8 feet by, and one guy said, "Too bad Tiger's taking you out, you're choking."
Mediate did no such thing, nailed the putt, and gestured good-naturedly back at the crowd.
I interact with them all the time, too. I love it, though. I think it's cool. They're hilarious. They know everything about you. They have these little sheets. It's beautiful. I wish we had one every week.
The crib sheets to which Mediate refers are filled with esoterica shouted at the appropriate moment. A birthday wish to one player, the name of another's dog, or a joint cheer for golfer Scott Hebert and his caddy. Most golfers acknowledge the crowd, play through the hubbub, and often toss the ball to the fans on the way to the 17th. From his front row seat, Gary Palm says he's been coming to this hole from Minnesota for the past 3 years.
I remember one year a guy hit a bad shot, and he reached in his bag, and he took out about a dozen hats, and he threw them up in the crowd and said, "Sorry, it was a bad shot." It was pretty funny.
Golfer Brad Adamonis' debut on 16 this year proved more of an adventure when extra pressure exerted from the crowd helped trigger his vertigo.
I hit my shot in the bunker, and then I had to wait like about 10 minutes on the tee because I had vertigo. They were kind of booing me, you know how they are, right? And then I hit a bunker shot that I was in a buried lie, and I hit a pretty good bunker shot. They still booed me. And then I hit like about a 15-foot putt, and I made it. So they went nuts. So I went from boo, boo. Then I was a hero.
Oh, yeah! About time! Yeah! Woo!
No one, including current tournament chairman John Felix, really knows how the creative rowdiness became par for the 16th hole. But Felix can recall a defining moment in 1997, an ace by a young Tiger Woods.
It's Saturday afternoon with our largest crowd that had ever encircled the hole. You know, he knocks it in the hole right after that, and the people, it was mayhem, and people went bananas. And then there was this kind of spontaneous, as he was walking off the tee, everyone just started to throw their drinks onto the tee. The environment was electric. I mean, it was unbelievable.
Felix likens that outpouring of love and alcohol to a champagne toast. But since those days, the tournament's directors, in an attempt to tone down the noisiness and rein in the commentary, have moved fan watering holes farther from the action on 16. Still, on one side of the green, a few dozen 20 and 30-somethings wear bright orange T-shirts inscribed where beers and birdies collide and are drinking their fill. They're also providing a running review of what the competitors are wearing.
I think Periwinkle looks great on a guy. That's fantastic. What a great color. It's like Easter.
Ooh. You sure it's not lavender?
No, I think it's more of a periwinkle. I think it's a combination, but periwinkle's hot.
Many of the golfers here agree that the 16th hole is good for their usually staid business. But the rowdiness has reminded some of the Ryder Cup competition 10 years ago in Brookline, Massachusetts, when the constant heckling of European golfers by American fans caused a minor international incident. Veteran Jeff Maggart says things are different here.
I played on that Ryder Cup team in 99. I would say the Ryder Cup's a lot more mean-spirited. You know, out here at this tournament, everybody's just kind of loud and boisterous, and they're not really rooting against anybody. They're just out here to kind of yell and scream and have a good time.
Have you had any episodes where you've been booed?
Well, I missed the green today, and they booed me, so that's just, I deserve to be booed. I hit a pretty bad shot.
Of greater concern, say the fans in the general admission section, are the proliferating corporate boxes and creeping gentrification of the site many have been coming to for more than a decade. Until last year, they would cram onto the hillside looking down on the green. Now they have to scramble for the 3,000 greenside seats in a new grandstand, leaving hundreds more to wait in line outside. Jeff Summers is already looking back to the good old days.
This is the first year that they've had these general admission grandstands. I think probably to limit the partying, to limit us getting crazy, and You know, our theory is in a couple years this might be all corporate, and we're hoping that doesn't go that direction. And by the end of the day, you'll hear us chanting corporate sucks, because they always kill the wave, and they kill the partying, and they kill the fun. So, yeah, they're a little too stuffy up there for us.
But Summers, who designed those orange T-shirts, says he'll be back with his buddies and a host of things to shout to the passing golfers next year. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Josh Levenshurs. We had help this week from Kirk Carapeza and from Bob Anderson at WLIU in Southampton, New York. Special thanks to the Only a Game Hadrian's Wall players, Alistair Drummond, George Hicks, and introducing Karen Given as Faye Ray. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view our photo galleries, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word is from the gallery at the 16th hole of TPC Scottsdale. Hey, people, how do you like the show this week? They love us. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. In 2 seconds flat, the air is filled with a grandiose assortment of wordy dirt. Yeah, golf is a cussing game. Rip face, rubbernecking, fussing game. Gosh, dirt, dag, nap, cock, doodle, mucker, flap, kiss my every lover. Yeah, golf is a cussing game. Rip face, rubbernecking, fussing game. Gosh, turn.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.